My name is Dorothy Bass. I'm a church historian. And as I thought about this week at Holden Village, what I really wanted to lift up, in a sense, was what Christians of different families can learn from each other. And tonight I'm going to talk about one of the families within the Christian tradition, which I'm calling in the title the Free Church Tradition, though there are lots of different names for it, and I'll get into that in a moment. In the first session that I did a couple of days ago, a couple of you were there, I tried to, in a sense, rehabilitate the idea of a tradition as something that's alive and not dead. That we all belong to traditions, that we are, even though our faith is very much a personal thing and something that we have to bear alone before God, in one sense, it comes to us through the real social organisms that we belong to, that we either join or were born into. It comes to us with certain liturgical forms that feel right, and others that just don't feel right. It stretches through the generations. But stretching through the generations means that it stretches through our generation just as much as it stretched through those of the past. Right? And that we ourselves are bearing the traditions into the future and are responsible for reshaping them, for helping Christianity to grow into the future through our own lives, our own beliefs, our own behaviors. Okay? Now, within the Christian faith, there's a lot of diversity. I mean, obviously, there's national kinds of diversity. It's different in Africa and in North America and in different neighborhoods in North America. But there also are certain streams of theology and worship and ways of organizing church life, which are distinctive and which each one, I think, has a particular slant on the Christian tradition, its own kind of perspective to offer. In the World Council of Churches, when they discuss ecumenical relations among different Christian bodies, they talk about tradition two different ways. One is with a capital T.
Crank on the site tightening there so it doesn't roll on.
Yes, I think that's
right. There's one on the other side also.
Seems to be.
It's not totally effective, but it helps.
It helps, all right. And they talk about tradition and they talk about traditions. That all Christians belong to the Christian tradition, that by which we are constituted as Christians, through the incarnation, crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. But then that gets interpreted, lived out in different ways within the separate traditions. Sometimes they talk about world confessional families. So that Lutheranism, for instance, is a world confessional family. Okay? Sharing a confession takes place in different ways in different cultures around the world. Roman Catholicism is a world confessional family. Orthodoxy is a world confessional family. The Reformed tradition is another. And another one, the one I wanted to lift up tonight, can be variously called Free Church, Believer's Church, whatever. Let's see. Or the Believer's Church. We think that we all belong to Believer's Church, but they want to say that we let people in, Lutherans, Catholics, Presbyterians, and so on, who are not yet believers, don't we? We christen them when they're infants, we baptize them when they're infants, we make them Christians before they can believe. Okay? They have a vision of the church as four, made up of committed believers. So sometimes you call this the Believer's Church tradition. Now, in order to kind of lay out what I mean by this, I'd like to tell some historical stories and to put this into a longer story of Christian faith. When I say free, What it really means is free from the state. Okay? Free from alliances with the ruling powers. Which was true of the early church. Right? In the first 3 centuries of the church's life, the Roman Empire would not permit Christians to join the army because Christians did not worship the emperor. 150 years later, you had to be a Christian to join the army because the Roman Empire had become a Christian entity. A big change. Okay? That is not the free church. That is the a church in alliance with the government. I speak of the free church, I really mean something which they thought, the people who belonged to this tradition, conceive as closer to what the early church did. Okay. In the Middle Ages, the church and state were very much wrapped up with each other. You remember this from high school history, however long ago it was, right? Now, sometimes there are tensions between kings and bishops and popes, but basically, they found ways of working together. Sometimes this took extreme forms, such as in the Crusades, when armies were raised, wars were fought by the church, together with the state. And even when there were tensions and struggles, as there often were over who would control certain land and so on, it would be the struggle between princes, the bishops as princes, the rulers as princes, so that the church was in a sense like the state. It had a ruler at the top who wore something like a crown, lived in palaces, and so on, down through in parallel to the state. But even in that time, that was the dominant arrangement, there have always been Christians who, when they heard the gospel, interpreted it in a more radical way, and interpreted it as a call to the kind of thing that you read about in, say, the Beatitudes, in the Gospels. Okay. St. Anthony, this is long ago, 250 AD, in Egypt, a rich young man walked into church in the year 250, heard the gospel lesson being read. It was the rich young ruler, according to all stories, and I believe this to be true, he heard it said, "And what must I do to be saved? Take all you have and sell it and give it to the poor." Anthony, the rich young man, did that. That's what it said. He did it, sold all that he had, moved to the desert, became one of what they called the Desert Fathers, founded a monastic community where they lived in poverty, prayer, and simplicity in the desert. And in every generation of Christians, there are people who respond to the gospel that way, even if the church is living high on the hog, even if the people at the top are in alliance with the government. There are always people who hear the gospel and who hear it in that more radical way. St. Francis was a good example in the Middle Ages. Right? He would hear the "Blessed are the poor in spirit" and really take that to heart and think, what would it be like, St. Francis of Assisi, to really empty my spirit and to be poor in spirit? And he became friends with the animals, with the birds and the... and lived in poverty and gathered people around him and lived in community. There are lots of examples in that period of time. Monastic life, men and women, both in communities, trying to really live up to what they thought was the radical demand of the gospel through the Middle Ages. Okay, the Protestant Reformation comes along. Martin Luther. Let me ask, how many are Lutheran here? I'm assuming a basically Lutheran audience. No, okay. Does anybody else want to identify themselves as something else? Or,
Protestant?
Generally Protestant.
UCSC, Evangelical.
Oh, okay, And you said you were from a Catholic background, or you'd rather not identify yourself? Okay. Okay, all right.
What about you?
Oh, I'm United Church of Christ, I'm sorry.
I'm Lutheran now, but I grew up in an evangelistic Baptist.
Okay.
Tradition.
All right. Okay. I'm United Church of Christ, which would be, which is not that well known by some people, but it's a union of many different Protestant groups on the liberal side. Some Lutheran, some Reformed, the Congregationalists, who are the Pilgrims and the Puritans, okay, are in that group also. Okay. So Martin Luther and all of those guys come along and make many significant challenges to the medieval church. One thing they want to say, I mean, the most radical, most important one is the way in which one is redeemed, is redefined to be justification by faith. Most Lutherans will know about that, I think. There are changes in the liturgy so that all the people commune in bread and wine, which had not happened in the Middle Ages. The Bible is translated into the language of the people, given to them. People are encouraged to believe on their own. Okay. And the priesthood of all believers is lifted up. The idea that the Christian life is the same for all, and that we all need to learn to live as Christians, not leave it to the nuns and the monks. Okay. But one thing they did not change was their alliance with the state. Luther's Reformation would have had no chance of succeeding politically without the protection that he received from the prince in the region where he lived, okay. who agreed with Luther, but who for his own reasons, also political reasons, protected the Reformation, let his territory become a Lutheran territory instead of a Catholic one. Same thing with the other reformers. John Calvin was a preacher in Geneva, theologian who founded the Reformed tradition, the Presbyterian Church, and so on. And he, together with the rulers of the city where he was, would persecute heretics, okay, using the civil authority to enforce religious, what he thought was religiously correct. Okay. Zwingli, one of the other major reformer, died in battle, fighting the Catholics. Okay. So the reformers made many changes in a more democratic direction, but they retained the alliance with the state. But in those early years of the Protestant movement, people were reading the Bible in fresh ways. They were having it put in their hands. Okay, they were being told that they could understand this and read it and see what it said for their own lives. They were hearing words about the equality of the people of God with the priests and the nuns and monks. Okay, about every person believing for themselves. They were getting messages of democracy, of democratic freedom type messages. And in this context, again, a more radical movement of response to the claims of what they read in the New Testament took place. And a movement of people emerged who wanted to say, the Protestant Reformation, the reformers are not taking this far enough. If we really want to be like what we are reading about in the New Testament, we need to go further. We need to reform the church much further. And so communities of people emerged in many different places on their own. It wasn't just one person who thought this up and spread it to the others. But in Germany, Switzerland, Holland, Czechoslovakia, all across there, groups of people reading the New Testament for themselves decided that they could live out the claims in a more full way. And from this we get the first and most, I think, the most radical impulse within what I would call the Free Church tradition.
Isn't underlying all this, though, the economic theme, though, really, because the church controlled basically the finances, and were taxing all these fiefdoms, these lords and so forth, and they didn't want to do that. And so, not that Martin Luther wanted to start his revolution, but they jumped on it as a way of looking at, hey, we don't have to pay the Pope. We can, you know, money is good. We can handle it. We don't have to have the Jewish people handling it, you know, for the Pope.
Right. Well, this might be true of a lot of the rulers in their
sure.
And also, you know, why should Italy be running Germany?
That's right.
Right. You know, in France, the Protestant movement was eliminated with a huge massacre for political reasons. So yes, there are political, there definitely are. I think, but I think this will tie in to the Anabaptists. Okay, now the, we say use the word Anabaptist now. I mean, it's kind of a technical term. Today, these people are not, they're not our American Baptists. Okay, they're not like our our regular Baptists down the street. These
ones, Church of the Brethren.
Church of the Brethren.
And your, of course, your Amish and your Mennonite.
Right, right.
But Quakers.
Quakers
are
similar. They come along more than 100 years later, and in a different place, and they're kind of different. They're this, I'd say it's the same idea of let's get back, let's do it more fully, let's reform the church more fully. But they're from a different type. Here, I think the important, the really key groups are Mennonites are very important here. Yeah, Amish, Church of the Brethren. Hutterites? Anybody out here? Now, this is an interesting case with the economic question. Peter Hutter in Peter Riedemann and Johann Hutt, who founded the Hutterites, they thought when they read the New Testament, what they read was hold all things in common. And they developed a whole critique. That's, and this is in 1550, a whole critique of society that was arranged by ownership. And they would, I mean, they would interpret the whole Bible this way. Look at the creation. God gave it to all. You know, they could go through every part of Christian belief and interpret it with why private property was problematic. And they're still living in not too far north of here, very prosperous communities. So, and they were part of this Anabaptist movement. Anabaptist means re-baptizing. Okay, we call it re-baptizing because, you know, in Europe in 1530, everybody had already been baptized as babies, as part of just being a German person or a Swiss person or whatever, that was part of the deal. And they wanted to say that baptism was nothing. That really didn't count. And as they read the New Testament, they believed that the church needed to be gathered out, not to be the whole society with a Christian name on it. The church needed to be gathered out of the society and to stand apart and to be visibly different from the rest of society and to make strong moral claims on its people. Okay? Who would voluntarily commit themselves to follow this kind of discipleship? And that's why they call it, that's why they would say believer's church. And re-baptism. Baptism becomes the ritual symbol of that. From the 1520s to 1618, baptizing an adult, okay, re-baptizing someone was a capital offense in most parts of Europe. And up to 5,000 people were martyred for this. And for the first ones, in about 1524, to make the choice not to baptize their own infants because of what they thought the church needed to become. See, I mean, that's really heavy, okay? I mean, some of the early ones decided not to baptize their own infants, not to present for baptism, and to themselves baptize one another. It was a capital offense.
Yeah, because the way the state church attacked it was a seditious act of denying your citizenship, your American nationality.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And that's what's tremendously interesting from the point of view of those of us who sit in comfortable churches where being, I come from a Presbyterian background, I use that for example. I mean, what, growing up for me, being sort of a solid citizen and a good Presbyterian was about the same thing, right? I mean, you're an honest person in business and, you know, faithful in certain kinds of ways. But nothing that would radically, or even not radically, differentiate you from the rest of society, right? Does that ring true? Okay. File for, now even now in Indiana where I live, there are Amish communities which are very clearly still claiming their separation from the world. And it's that kind of challenge which they really discovered for themselves in their own rereading of the New Testament and in that period of time. Martyrdom that was associated with this for a lot of them, for typically this is just an interesting, horrible little twist, would be done by drowning. Because isn't that the punishment appropriate to that particular crime? Water. Mm-hmm. And there are very, heartbreaking letters and stories and so on about that. But when those persecutions ended in the 17th century, the category of conscientious objector had become a reality in those countries. I should say more about that. The key ideas, the key things that would mark this community that would be so identifiably Christian, one is the peace testimony. Okay, and really the best word for these Mennonite-type churches would not be free churches, but peace churches. These are the historic peace churches. It is just out of the question to join the armed forces. Or to resist evil in other ways. There are stories of settlers in Pennsylvania where there was religious liberty and where they were almost recruited to settle, and where they still live as the Pennsylvania Dutch. When in conflicts with Native Americans, they did not fight back. They just did not fight back. The Quakers did the same thing in Pennsylvania, and they had peace in that region. They did not fight back. There are stories that the Hutterites in North Dakota still carry since they were German. When the First World War came along, there was all in the United States was fighting against Germany. They would not sign up for the army. Three of their young men were beaten to death in prison. And that testimony is still repeated over and over and over in that community. Now, among the Hutterites. Yeah?
When it was first started, were they strictly going by what the gospel preached, or was it because they were set apart from the state? Or a combination?
They had to make it up as they went along, in a sense. Okay? No,
yeah,
but.
That's what mm-hmm. you think. But, yeah.
Right. I think that it was as early as 1527, 3 or 4 years after any of these people ever existed, that they got together to draft their first confession, which is called the Schleitheim Confession. You know, who are we as a people? And there are 7 articles, and one of them is we renounce the use of the sword, as they called it. And they could not be blacksmith. If you're a blacksmith, you can't fix somebody's sword. You know, I mean, it's just that kind of total commitment. I think it came from their reading of Scripture. Yeah, I think it. They put it all together. No taking of oaths, no holding of public office. And Luther makes a point to say that you can be a Christian and be an executioner. You know, I mean, if the state is working in an orderly way, you as a Christian are called to participate in the workings of the state. And if that means you're drafted to serve as executioner, fine. You know, or in any post in the army, or, whatever. That
that was, and the Lutheran tradition has continued to evolve from that, but at that time, that was the point.
Yeah. Well, you can see from the Lords back in those days, in 1527 to right now, mm-hmm. in the United States of America, mm-hmm. there's no profit from having people like that amongst your midst. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to spread, so you're going to persecute them.
Yeah.
When the parable you were talking about, hold
true.
All things in common, mm-hmm. like the Amish, this tinges on socialism, which you don't sell your products, there's no, you know,
right.
moving around,
right.
and you know what, socialism has a taste in the
yeah.
government we have today,
mm-hmm.
they'll stomp it out any kind of can.
No, this is true. This is true, and the Hutterites, who are the ones who are the real communists, they're not just socialists, they're communists. I mean, they have no personal private property at all in their community. They were persecuted to the point, they were down to 50 people at one point, and ended up living in Russia for a long time, and just moved again and again and again, each time persecuted out. Because and they are like a light to the world. You know, I mean, they're a city on a hill, in a sense. They're living out something which I think other Christians kind of know might be right,
they're
but
they,
you know, they can't.
Right, you can't make any money off them or exploit them.
Right, right, right.
But what were the original teachings of Jesus? See?
Right,
the
right.
The message you go back to, because he appealed to the lower, to the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's...
Mm-hmm. That's right. They were, and you know, and even those who were not, most of the people who were attracted to this were poor. Okay, most of it was not economically communist. Most of it was farm people who would join together in community. Like the Amish own their own farms even now, but they form a community, which is a very close community.
Okay? They'd have to be on. They'd have to be on a farm because they have to raise their own. That's
right.
The only way they could stay alive.
Right.
They couldn't do that in the city.
Right. And your own children. Raise your own food, but also
yeah.
your own. Yes, yes, that's right. And in fact, there was a big Supreme Court case in, I think, 1973, which permits Amish people to keep their children out of school after eighth grade. One of the last pro-religious liberty decisions made by the Supreme Court. By the way, there hasn't been another one for 18 years, but that was one. Different question. So renouncing the sword is one key mark. There's a lot of emphasis on community. Part of the issue for instance, if I would think of following what the medieval people called the councils of perfection, the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount, to do that as an individual is harder, I think. It's difficult than to do it as a community. Okay? If you work for the Mennonite Church today, and you say, please do not withhold taxes from my paycheck, they will not withhold taxes from your paycheck, and their whole legal structures are there to help you. And they will do that as a body, in other words. Even though I work for a church institution, my church won't do that for me, right? I mean, they go along with the law. If I just chose to be a tax resister, I'm on my own,
mm-hmm.
right? Whereas this is all focused on community. And so there's a lot of stuff in the early confessions about, for us, communion means community. We're not really interested in body and blood, you know, I mean, in the sense of, is this transubstantiation? In what sense is this the body of Christ? So we're talking about this is the community gathered. Okay. And so there's a lot of ritual emphasis on that. And this is enacted in Mennonite churches today in a beautiful way, in part singing. They're very much into singing together in parts, in harmony, to show forth what the community means in a ritual sense. But you said,
Well, the original premise of sharing of the bread, the Last Supper, I think, from that premise, the whole thing flows that I almost stand back and look at Jesus as a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, the church doesn't stand up at all when socialism
uh-huh.
has such a bad name in America. I mean,
uh-huh.
just, you know,
uh-huh.
we just cower down. And it's kind
right.
of interesting because instead of we tend to look at the more money you make, the better, you know, mm-hmm. better off you are. The bigger mm-hmm. the church you can build, the bigger. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything goes backwards as far as I can see. Right?
Right. I agree with that completely.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. The other key idea that comes up over and over in their talk about themselves is what they call separation from the world. Okay? It's a very explicit countercultural claim. You know, that if you're Christian, as the Schleierheim Confession says, we will not run with them in their abominations. And it's very judgmental over against what most of us are doing most of the time. But if you think about it, I mean, it's a very valid concept. If you're a Christian, to what extent do you run with the world, kind of a code word for a dominant society, in the wickedness of their abominations? Okay? And in what way can you symbolically and in your life show that you're different, you know, by being Christian? Well, now, sometimes this gets stuck in that tradition. So that they will have their arguments, not over doctrine, okay, not over biblical interpretation. They'll have their arguments over what does it mean to be separate from the world. So that, but if your cows give more milk, if they're listening to music, you can put one in the barn. I mean, so there are these, it can become very legalistic, what does it mean to be separate? Okay, but that's the question. And I think for the more, the largest group of Mennonites is more integrated into American society than the others, in that you can't tell them if you run into them. And they are beginning to do things like send their ministers to seminary and build church buildings with steeples on top and that kind of thing, which they didn't do for a long time. Okay. So in a sense, they're becoming more like other churches. But they still have, their debates will be over what does it mean to be separate from the world? Where should you draw that line? And that's something that I think is a real challenge also. So I see people nodding. You see some challenge in that? But okay, so why aren't you like that? Or why isn't your church like that? Seriously. I mean, are there some legitimate problems with it, or some if it's attractive, maybe we should all enact it at once? We'd have to study more about it, but what do you think? Why are we not like that, every church?
The legalistic idea. Is this grace, or is this kind of rules?
Okay. Do these groups share their gospel with the neighbors down the street?
Church
or do they just reach their own family groups?
That's a good question. Very good question. Church of the Brethren has been the one that is really evangelistic. And in fact, they were formed somewhat later, but along the same principles. And they have been and still are very open to receiving members from outside. Sometimes the members they receive are the ones who grew up Amish, don't want to be quite that much. You want to move a little bit closer to the flow of things. It gets mixed up with ethnicity in this country now. I mean,
half of them don't seem to win converts.
Right.
They intermarry in the different colonies.
Mm-hmm.
The girls from one colony would marry into another colony.
Right.
But I think the Mennonites possibly would intermarry and convert.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Didn't you have personal experience with some of these communities or groups?
I used to have to play basketball against the Mennonites, and they were all probably strong farm kids and beat the Dickens out.
Uh-huh. Where was that? Iowa, Indiana?
North part of the state.
Up here.
They've got a heavy farm community up
mm-hmm.
there.
Uh-huh.
I didn't really rub shoulders with them.
Yeah.
With Amish in Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh. Yes. You know, I was looking over some notes on this afternoon. Apparently in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, there are 12 different kinds who are a little bit at odds with each other, and you can tell by the different way they dress. So what this tendency to separate can get legalistic, as you said. And Luther's comment, this, you made a good Lutheran statement there. Luther's comment was, Christ is not a new Moses. You get to think about that. What does that mean? Christ is not a new Moses. Yeah. I mean, is the gospel a word of grace, or is it a set of laws? Well, you know, there's a tension there, I think. But different traditions, small t, come out differently on that.
You know.
Yeah.
But I did not grow up in any of these group of churches. Okay. But I grew up in generalized American evangelistic uh-huh. churches, and they have many of the ideas of believer churches.
Right.
You come to the belief as an adult, mm-hmm. and you make a confession, and you get baptized all the way under three yeah. times. But there's a lot of, and they've got some other things, there's a lot of this separation from the world
uh-huh.
and debate about that as to how uh-huh. you live your lifestyle and right. are separated.
Right.
And that idea comes through in a lot of our American churches,
mm-hmm.
especially those that we think of as being in the evangelistic or okay. the fundamentalist tradition. Some of those ideas were picked right. up and adapted into those okay. newer traditions.
Right. Let me ask you, when you thought about that, how do we live our lives separate from the world, did that have a political content or more of a moral, like drinking,
moral,
smoking,
moral.
Dancing?
Yeah, they weren't into the peace movement.
Yeah. So. I mean, sometimes the separation from the world in the American evangelical movement or in the...
Yeah, it's different.
It's interesting. It's still the same concept. Principle, you know, but whether this is a political statement, which it has been for the peace churches. It has been for the peace churches, but it's not always for the evangelical free, other evangelical free church type people.
There's a difference between it being a privatized mm-hmm. statement and mm-hmm. and it being a community statement,
right.
too.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You want to say more?
Well, is it a matter of individual spirituality, and,
right.
or is it a matter of the community?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And when the whole community together witnesses peace,
then you get political.
Yeah. Then you get political. That's right. And I think that's really what these churches have done. And the other thing is, many of our churches, Lutheran, ELCA, and my own church, United Church of Christ, will make pronouncements on behalf of peace, which I think are heartfelt. But the whole idea of a way of life which could really separate you from the military dominance of the culture, for instance, or from the war-making powers of the United States, is it? That's beyond the lifestyle, the embedded social character of most ELCA and United Church of Christ and other congregations. Whereas here, it seems that is really worked into the whole life of the church. Does that make sense, or is that not fair to the other? What do you think?
I was going to ask you, uh-huh. wasn't a Mennonite group that got in trouble just recently? There were National Guards, and they didn't want to go over to fight in the desert conflict.
Wasn't I can't imagine them being National Guard.
They never should have joined
a National Guard. You're in that.
Yeah, I don't think it was a real
Mennonite
would have joined
Mennonite.
National Guard.
There was a group of Mennonites that got themselves in trouble because they wouldn't go over.
Yeah, I would be very surprised if they would join the National Guard.
Well, maybe they weren't in the National Guard. They were Mennonites who wouldn't go over.
Well, they wouldn't, yeah. I wonder if they were...
They might be trained in medical unit, but that would be
yeah.
all.
Mm-hmm. In fact, they have led the way in things like alternative service over
yeah.
the years.
Yeah.
I mean, for
yeah.
200 years, in this whole history of the United States, these movements have been the ones which have forged out the legal basis of conscientious objection and the alternative status, yeah. service, and so on.
They can serve as doctors and nurses.
Yes, they do, and they do it. They've done it, you know, very... boldly and so on, you know, sacrificially. Anything else here? Let's see if there. the sense of that I think they really experienced in the early, in the founding years, of that rage at the compromised church, I mean, the church that is not adequately reformed, you know, is something which I think appears in every generation. Also, it's a common Christian feeling of that the church is not being sufficiently faithful. But they did something about it, which not all of us, not all Christians do. I'd like to hear anything else that you want to say about this before just introducing the other Baptist groups, but anything?
Can I ask a question?
Sure, please.
There is such a, well, a denomination anyway, kind of maybe a splinter group as the Lutheran Free Church, I think. Is that a Lutheran group that has broken off from the main Lutheran group? Is it free in the sense of this kind of free, or only because it's broken off from the main church?
I don't know that specific. Free from the state. I don't know.
State.
Yeah, my guess is this is Church of Sweden Pietists, or Church of Norway Pietists, or Church of Denmark Pietists, who became more heartwarmed and evangelical than the church, and were offended at the bishops and their laxity and their moral failings and their inadequate piety. You know, sometime in 1810 or something like, I mean, I'm making this up, but this happens. This happens all the time. This happens all the time. And if you're in a place, and yet they belonged to the Lutheran State Church, right? Mm-hmm. And they got revived. Mm-hmm. They got pious. They wanted to break off and do a better church. They probably called it the Lutheran Free Church. And there's a rapidly growing denomination called the Evangelical Free Church, which started out of the Church of Sweden, and which is founding churches around now, which is generically American Evangelical.
But they're not a peace church.
But they're not a peace church. Yeah. No, they're not a peace
but
church.
Break
that's
with
right.
The state church.
Are they a right. Believers church?
They
they're pietistic, but that kind
I'm
of
not sure.
Evangelical.
I bet they might be, but I
the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Canada is a believers church.
They are.
At a Baptist.
Okay. I wouldn't be surprised because once you're out in that evangelical world, there's strong pressure in that direction.
Yeah.
Okay. Once you're into a framework of you have to be born again, okay? And in the American context, all these churches influence one another, right? I mean, we get out there and we all kind of mix it up, you know. And you look at the Lutheran Book of Worship; it's full of the hymns of other groups, you know, written by Methodists and Presbyterians and Catholics and all kinds of folks, and vice versa. And within the evangelical movement, there's a lot of pressure towards Believers Church. Okay. Now the other Baptists, the ones that we think, the ones that are the largest Protestant family in the United States, with the Southern Baptist Convention being the biggest, two huge African American Baptist denominations, okay, with one with 7 million, one with 4 million members, some Black Baptists, in other words, and the American Baptist churches, which you are a minister in, right? Which used to be the Northern Baptist Church, right? are the other Baptist churches, and they share much in common with this. I don't know if I did right to put them in this session or not. In believers, the idea of voluntary adult commitment, okay, as the basis for Christian life and community, they tend to be non-liturgical and non-creedal. In other words, we're interested in the Bible and preaching, but all this chanting of psalms and, you know, the Lord be with you and also with you and all that would just never go over, okay? And vestments and lots of the trappings of more churches that are closer to the Reformation, the non-free Reformation. Tradition.
I don't know what the word liturgy means.
No, not really. Although every group has one.
Yeah.
They don't know it. I mean, because you change it and you find out that they have one. Right?
Having come from that tradition, it was a real adjustment to get into Lutheran.
Right.
And now I go to Orthodox Byzantine liturgy.
Uh-huh.
Liturgy nut.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a hostility to what they would call the trappings.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, yeah, in other words, low church. Okay. And there's an effort in that to be democratic. I mean, to have all people, I mean, to play down the distinction between clergy and laity, although forms of hierarchy can creep in. Because the charismatic preacher can be tremendously powerful in this tradition.
Okay. But still, it's pretty much congregationally based.
But it's yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the terms of a power, and while you may have structures, there are more administrative structures, and those are those people don't have any power over the local church.
Right.
Placement of ministers is between the minister and the church. And
right.
The church.
Right.
And
right.
If the hierarchy doesn't like it, tough.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I see them in their roots. This is really a continental thing.
Right. That's right.
Free tradition, mm-hmm. But it's kind of a cross between English Puritanism,
mm-hmm.
Influenced by some of the, well, I know they were influenced by the Mennonites. Belief, and it's a cross between that
right.
And this free trade
right.
Church tradition with an English flavor somewhere or American frontier flavor.
Right. No, that's exactly right. This family really emerges out of English Protestantism.
Right.
It's these are the people in the English Protestant Reformation who are saying, go further, go further, go further. We've been reading the Bible and you should do more. And they follow much of it, but they don't separate from the world in the same political sense. Right? They don't take on that peace witness. They want the church to leave, they want the state to leave the church alone, and they believe firmly in the separation of church and state until recently.
Yeah.
Until recently. But we'll get, but I mean that Roger Williams, for instance, thought that the magistrates, the rulers, should not be about enforcing what he called the first table of the law. It's not the work of the government to tell people not to blaspheme. That's the work of the church. Okay. And the government can be against stealing, murder, the things of the second table of the law. But the things that are between the believer and God, the government should not be about that. For a long time, there has been a lobby in Washington. The Baptist Joint Commission on Church and State, or
yeah,
something
yeah,
like that.
Joint
Interim.
I thought it
broke
down
affairs.
And well, the Southern Baptist Convention pulled out all the money recently, but they've always lobbied against prayer in the public schools.
Except the moderates in the Southern Baptists have taken their money out of the Southern Baptists
right.
And are now funding it.
Putting it back in. Joint Baptist Committee. That's what it is. Joint, right.
It's all an article, right?
Do you see? No, but I mean, there's been a hostility. They don't want the state. They don't want the flag in their church, and they don't want the state to be doing religion which the church should be doing. Okay, that's the heritage. But in the American scene, with all this civil religion and political nature, and without that peace witness, there has been a lot of acculturation, so that the Baptist Church has lost some of that. And the Southern Baptist Convention now is going through tremendous agony as the fundamentalist group has been taking it over.
They've lost their anti-creedal stance.
Yep.
And,
yep.
And
right. They're trying to. They're now making seminary professors sign creeds, which is totally against the Baptist heritage. They're the ones who have taken it over, who have a very specific political conservative agenda.
Couldn't you also lump in with the Baptists here, just a whole slew of others,
yes.
Who disciples, a assembly, who also come a little later,
mm-hmm.
But still come out of that Presbyterian English
right.
background.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Do you know the Disciples of Christ, Christian Church Disciples of Christ?
Yeah, that's my
that's your church. Okay. And there have been two breakoffs from that, which are now bigger than that. Church of Christ, which is throughout the South, and what do they call the other one? National Conference of Christian Churches or something, which are...
North American Conference of Christian Churches.
Right, which broke off again, both of them in a more conservative direction. You know,
and
getting
doesn't the Church of Christ have two different branches?
Oh, they got a lot
probably. Really. But see, there's this quest, the point is that there's in this whole sectarian movement, there's a quest for the New Testament church. And it will the people will pick up certain standards and, for instance, the Church of Christ, it is no instrumental music.
Right. Is there apostolic
There's no instrumental music in the Orthodox Church either. No.
Apostolic churches in Canada. I've heard apostolic, they call themselves. In
apostolic.
Canada.
It's there's something like 35,000 denominations in North America. No, but this
and
whole...
two-thirds of them are Baptists.
Probably right. That's probably right. Right. Sometimes we talk about all of these as restorationist movements. In other words, this drive to restore the church to its New Testament form. There's been in every generation there are people who think we can get it back to what it was in its New Testament form, and they will again scan the scriptures and try to enact what they take to be the form of church order, which is appropriate. I mean, for some this can be snake handling. This is not the Baptists, you know. Or something will be seized upon as the mark that comes from the New Testament.
But if they seize upon, you know, so clearly on one thing, like, you know, someone who's snake handling, how can they be so focused on one thing that becomes the be-all and end-all of their group, that they, you know, are they ignoring the rest, or is it like the rest isn't as important?
I think the rest is taken for granted. Even people who think that they're breaking with the traditions out of which they come carry it along. I mean, they're still doing their Bible reading and getting baptized at the appropriate moment and praying.
But isn't it bad? Isn't it always good to come back to the basics once in a while? Sometimes you go off on tangents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I mean to offer
maybe
this.
Maybe they are the current reformations that are occurring.
I think part of the problem, though, is when you grasp upon something and start saying, this is the truth, and this is the way that it has to be, and so we're not going to associate with you anymore because we have the truth and you don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, if they take that stance, then I can understand that. But I mean, as far as just, I'm making an overall general statement, is that very often you do have to get back to the basics because the reason they're doing this is because they feel that the churches have gotten far afield from the true meaning of the Bible, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just throwing this
right.
out as a...
Right, right. Well, there's a lot of religious energy in these movements. Mm-hmm. And I think we're talking about two or three different movements. Mm-hmm. But they do come, all of them, as challenges of one sort or another to the easy pew, as it might be called, and a lot of white middle class churches that I know.
Too comfortable in them.
The sense of high commitment membership is common here. So it can get lost.
Every
in
member a minister attitude.
Mm-hmm. 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 It's not a nice little thing to put in the bulletin.
Yeah. Bulletin says.
You've got right. to do something.
Right. Each one teach one, right? Or each one reach one. And with Southern Baptists, this would be very common. The other thing that I think is interesting about this tradition is the strong congregational focus. Now, a lot of denominations are becoming ipso facto more congregational. I mean, it's very hard for bishops to force ministers on, even in those churches where they have bishops, you can't force a minister on a congregation anymore because congregations have come into their own in a certain sense. But there is a real honoring of that the church is this face-to-face community, you know, rather than the large impersonal body farther away. Now, there are advantages to that, too. You know, different kinds. But here, the real honoring of the congregation as the church. So the American Baptist Churches is the name of the denomination, not the American Baptist Church. American Baptist Churches. And each one of those is a church. The whole thing is a denomination. It's not a church. But the churches are those local units. And that has given congregations a lot of freedom. And for instance, in the 19th century, this tradition, disciples, Baptists, Congregationalists, who are now in the United Church of Christ, ordained more women than anybody else. You know, by far, because they didn't have to wait for some national body to pass a law. If they wanted to call a woman, they would call a woman. On the other hand, they could get capped, they can become captive to local culture. And if the local culture is racist, the bishop can't do anything about it. You know, so, yeah.
In terms of the women, they ordained women first.
That's right.
But you look at the denominations that have the most success in placing women.
That's right.
And it's the ones that have a bishop structure that are able to exert mm-hmm. some pressure and say,
that's right,
women will go in here. And currently the Baptists and disciples are real poor in the terms of their percentage of mm-hmm. active women ministers, but they ordained them first.
They ordained them first.
Yeah. So what ordination's only good in the local area where you've got ordained.
But that's all
in terms of placement.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's right. The Methodists are doing best now, with their strong bishop system. But that's right. So the cat, in a sense, there's an opportunity for democracy arising from the grassroots. There's also a danger that the folk culture, with its biases, will take over the church completely. Whereas in a church that understands itself in connection with other churches around the world, down the street, denominational offices and so on, there's more opportunity for criticism coming back and forth. And for meeting people from other neighborhoods, as part of your Christian partnership, which can happen in a more connectional kind of church. Would you change your church in this direction at all, or any of these directions? There are lots of directions we've talked about, probably too many to straighten it out, but.
I don't know if I should say this, but I have the feeling that the Lutheran Church is getting too traditional, going back to too much tradition. I used to enjoy going to a church and listening to a long sermon. I may be alone in that, but now our sermons are 10 minutes or less. The rest is all ritual.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And you just sit there and you mind for the way you wouldn't pray. You can look at me and say, my, she would be a terrible person. Well, I've been talking to other people mm-hmm. and they feel the same way. Mm-hmm.
I'm joking. Four weeks ago, I got invited to a National Baptist Church. Now, that means Black Baptist.
Yes.
The sermon was long, but it didn't start until we were into the second hour of the service.
That's right.
And it took up most of the second hour of the service,
though. And before that was probably testimony. Was there testimony or just more music and prayer and stuff?
Mostly music and prayer and some other things going on. They didn't really have a testimony during that worship, this particular worship service, I think.
But testimony, which has been a strong tradition in a lot of these churches, in free church tradition, it's a ritual way also of honoring the individuals gathered there. They have something to say that would be edifying to others. Did you want to say something back there?
Oh, I sort of thinking out loud about the Lutheran Church and our desire to appeal to so many people to make disciples of all nations, to be that church to all people, and as a result, a lot of the unification is lost because earlier you were talking about specific movements, and I think of every time something comes down from the top. I read the Lutheran and I see letters to the editor saying it's great and it's terrible, and there's such diversity within that church, and it's what makes it great, but it's what keeps it from becoming a unified body as well, and so we struggle with that, and it will never be unified. Mm-hmm. It will only break off into those smaller mm-hmm. groups, or mm-hmm. or sometimes groups within congregations or whatever. And it's such a foreign concept to say we are one, and uh-huh. we will all act the same.
No, right.
Not
right.
in this church, you won't.
Right. Right.
But you know, yeah. the whole premise there.
Well, so but, you know, I think that's a really good characterization. And it's an example of how each one of these families, I think, has something to say without which the entire Christian witness is impoverished. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. that in that church like that, you need grace, right, to get along with all these different people, right? And that's what you've got. And, you know, it's very...
But by the same token, as a result of that, periodically, what you have happening is it is a group that is the creator of a lot of small unified groups. Simply because it is so general, it seems to spawn these mm-hmm. groups. Why I don't get along with them, so we better break off, but we need to be more concerned. No, we need to be more liberal mm-hmm. or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that's what happens when you try to be a church that brings right. people in rather than a church that comes from within and takes care of what you get.
Uh-huh.
Right. Interesting concept.
Right. Right. Okay, well, I guess it's time for Vespers.
Thank you.